From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest was probably good and sick and tired of me by now is Christopher Nolan, who's been coming here for 15 years now. I met him in Slam Dance in 1999 for his film Following, if you remember that, Chris.
Now you're making me feel old.
No. You're not old. I'm old. I'm still here. You've moved on to a couple of other projects. His newest project, by the way, is a beautiful new film, Interstellar. First of all, thanks so much for coming back. Always great to have you here.
Yeah, nice to be here. Thank you.
I guess we talked about so many things, and so many of these things seem to have come home to roost in this one. When you were last here, we talked a little bit about Dr. Zhivago and that emotional content, and that feels like that's a big part of this. And that kind of mirror effect where one character, your protagonist, is often sort of sees himself through someone else's eyes. And that really plays a big part of this film too, does it not?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I certainly, we've been talking for a long time about genre and about scale of films and trying to balance intimacy, you know, more relatable emotions, you know, with larger scale films, and definitely for me, Interstellar's kind of pushing that as far as I can. Really, I was very drawn to the central dilemma with the character. You know, he's a father. It's about his relationship with his kids. Really, it's about a family dynamic, but it takes on this huge potential event in mankind's evolution, the idea that one day, you know, the Earth is our nest and we may leave it and reckon with our place in the universe. And I really liked that balance. I mean, you mentioned Dr. Zhivago. I was thinking very much of the Spielberg stuff, you know, from the late 70s, early 80s, where you sort of like Close Encounters.
God, it's very much Close Encounters.
You know, you sort of take a huge potential event like that, but you sort of see it looking over the shoulder of a family, you know, and a family man and a relatable set of characters, and trying to balance the human with the spectacle, right?
It's funny, as you mentioned Spielberg, I was thinking about the way you use cars in your movies. I mean, just we can tell who and what somebody is by the kind of car they drive.
I think certainly with Matthew's truck, certainly with the Batmobile as well.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. You sort of think almost in all these cases. I was thinking about that, how these people are so defined for you. That physical idea of, I guess we call them props and costumes, but that idea of making these things seem as real as possible is so key to you, isn't it?
It's about the tactile quality of films. I really like films that you, as you watch them, the cinematography, the sound, everything gives you the feeling of, you know, what things would feel like, what they would smell like, you know, really, really trying to put the audience in there in a very physical way. And I think as far as aspects of character being expressed through props and everything, I mean, that to me, that's what movies are. You know, you're looking for a visual analogy of character traits. You're looking for a visual representation of narrative wherever possible. So things like what a character wears, what they drive, you know, all those things, I mean, they become very, very important.
But also there's a real sense, and again, this for me goes back to, we talked about this before, the British filmmakers who started making films, that sense of things being lived in.
Yeah. The age of them. I mean, I've always loved, you know, Ridley Scott's films, and Blade Runner was a sort of seminal film for me. And what he was doing in that film, as I understand it from, you know, interviews I've read with him and all this, was building on what he saw in Lucas's first Star Wars, which was also a huge inspiration for me. But in both of those films, everything's lived in, everything's aged and grimy. There's this incredible sense of use to things and history to things. And that really makes them feel like the real world. You really believe in those worlds, the future city, you know, of Blade Runner, or you know, the entire set of worlds of Star Wars. You believe in the technology. You really feel like you could live there, you know, and that to me is what makes them really exciting.
As you're talking about Star Wars, I was thinking about the dust storms on Tatooine, and that's almost the touchstone for the beginning of the film here.
Definitely. I mean, I think Star Wars somehow managed to have slightly the feel of a Western in those early scenes in Tatooine. And I think that one of the really guiding principles for us with Interstellar in the first act was to hark back to Philip Kaufman's The Right Stuff with its feeling of the Western. I mean, he, you know, introduces Chuck Yeager on horseback looking at the X-1. So there's this very, very specific visual idea that the pilot is sort of come from the iconography of the cowboy, you know, these great American icons. And we were certainly trying to be true to that with McConaughey's character, Cooper, and in Interstellar.
Well, this is a point of the show that I know is always your favorite part. You get to tell the audience what the movie's about.
Gosh, what's the movie about? Well, you know, Interstellar, I mean, really, for me, it's primarily about a father's relationship with his children, how it's tested by him having to head off out into the universe and save humanity, effectively. So it's really addressing a time in the future when the Earth is essentially telling us to leave. We're basically having to reckon with our place in the universe and say, okay, can mankind exist off this Earth? But ultimately, I think the film, it's an adventure. It's a journey that we ask the audience to go on, an experience that they follow. And I think ultimately, it's very much about humanity. It's very much about who we are as people and what connects us.
But I think that's kind of, each film has become a bigger adventure. If we go back to the first, which you're using sort of the conventions of noir just because of your limitations. But as your canvas has gotten bigger, each film has become a bigger, more epic adventure for you. It's like you're like using these sort of, you're making the story smaller, but you're like making the scope bigger. It's almost like you're going back to the movies that really roused you as a kid in movie theaters.
Very much trying always to get back to that experience of watching 2001, watching the first Star Wars, you know, on the big screen, and just getting that feeling of sitting there in the movie theater and being transported and the exciting possibilities of that. I've been sort of trying to get back to that with every film. And as the films have gotten bigger and as the potential technically for the films to get bigger, because I've had more and more things that I can, you know, avail myself of, more and more tools to tell the story, I really tried to push the idea of immersive cinema. I really tried with this film to give the audience an experience. It's a very, very simple story. That's sort of the point of it. It's simple. It has symbolic resonance, I think. But ultimately, you have to experience the film in a theater to get what it is.
By the way, it's the tribute, my guest is Christopher Nolan, whose newest film as director is the film Interstellar. The idea of hubris. So many of these films about a protagonist who thinks that he knows something and is basically called into, has that belief called into question. And I guess I wonder where that comes from for you.
Probably my own massive hubris. My own massive paranoia. I don't know where it comes from other than I'm really interested in cinema's ability to give you different points of view and multiple points of view within a single film. I've always really been fascinated by that relationship between the storytelling of movies and how it works and the way it aligns you with different characters, sometimes one character very strongly, sometimes a multitude of characters through a story. It's an incredibly versatile medium for that. And I kind of enjoy making that concern part of the text of the story. And so having characters who have a strong point of view that isn't necessarily giving them the whole picture, that tension between us as an audience and sitting there watching the film and the character's point of view that we're seeing it through, playing with that, moving away from it suddenly or gradually coming back to it, I find that to be a really engaging form of filmmaking.
And not to give too much away here, but it's interesting. There's a thing about the films Inception and Memento where there, strictly speaking, isn't a conventional villain. That duality, that sort of animus and hero is contained in the protagonist. And is that the kind of thing you feel you work best at when you basically have both sides and you're asking people to examine what their relationships are to conventional heroism?
I think certainly if the antagonist of the film to some degree comes from inside the protagonist or is reflective of something that's inside the protagonist. I think that's a very insidious form of evil, if you like, or antagonism or you know, drama. It's something we played with a lot in the Dark Knight trilogy, really in each of the three films. There's a strong element of the relationship between the flaws of the hero and the dark strengths of the villains. In the case of Interstellar, it's a film that very specifically, I think the antagonism in the story comes from a couple of different places. It certainly comes from various elements of humanity and you know our own flaws. But it also, if there is a protagonist, an antagonist in the film, I would consider it to be time. And it's really the first story where I've been able to indulge my obsession with time and how it plays in movies and everything as a story element rather than as a structural device, you know, or as a an element of point of view. It's really there as a character in the film, and I think ultimately does become very much the antagonist.
And it's funny because I guess I want this is one of the things we haven't talked about here. Just reading a bunch of stuff to get ready, you often the word cold is used, and I just think there's always an operatic sense of yearning in every one of your films. Mm. And I wonder why people tend to overlook that or dismiss that.
I don't think audiences do. Certainly the response that we've had over the years of the films we've put out, audiences do seem very much to get wrapped up in the operatic elements of what it is we're doing. And I think it's one of the reasons that the films have been successful, because people, they do get caught up in that operatic quality, which I think isn't cold. I think inherently there is a form of heightened emotion in there. But certainly I've always been interested in making films that have strong technical aspects to them, and the technical aspects being very foreground. You know, it's one of the reasons I make films, one of the reasons I'm fascinated by it. And I think that perhaps quite naturally when people analyze the approach of a filmmaker and they find a filmmaker who has an interest in the technology behind it, in the technique of it, they associate that with a certain objectivity or coldness. I mean, there's a tradition of that in movies, I suppose. As it applies to each film individually, I would hope that each film is different and has whatever emotional quality warmth that is needed for that particular story. I think Interstellar is quite obviously an emotional film. It actually deals with emotion as a narrative feature of the film. Of course, even as I talk about it like that, I'm starting to sound very cold about the place of emotion in the film. But I do find the film very emotional myself.
I do too, but I think if we look at your last four films, starting with Prestige, there's the big emotional component and that sort of regret being so key to these films too. But that sense of yearning and that thing you want that's just up there in your grasp that you can't have is central to all of these last few films that you've made.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I think that the idea of yearning, the idea of either trying to regain something that's been lost, I mean, really that idea I find very powerful. There's real pathos there. There's I think it's something that it's very human in its frailty. You know, the idea that our lives are imperfect and we have an idea of how we could make them better and we can't quite get there and strive for. I think it's I find that very moving. It's really about the frailty of human beings. It's the reason I always liked the Batman out of any comic book character, because I found him to be very frail, very human, very vulnerable in a way, emotionally. And I find stories about characters like that where we can really feel that dilemma, really relate to it. I find that very powerful. And that was my real point of connection with what Matthew was doing in Interstellar.
We'll take a break. Our guest is our old friend Christopher Nolan's new film is Interstellar. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm always thrilled to have Chris Nolan here. His new film is Interstellar. I think, though, as we were talking about this, since remember, you've cast these actors, be it Pacino or Christian Bale, or Hugh Jackman, or Matthew McConaughey here, who have, or Leonardo DiCaprio, who have that kind of audience connection. But these guys, again, think they know what they know. And there tends to be someone often, in this case of being Jessica Chastain, but we can look at Gary Oldman in the other films, or Michael Caine often plays that function too. It's a person who's kind of the audience surrogate, who's asking the common sense questions, because as smart as these guys are, they lack of kind of a crucial self-awareness.
Yeah, I think particularly with heroic figures in movies, it's very interesting, very careful. You have to be very careful with the relationship between the hero and the audience, because the heroic figure serves as a conduit for the audience's own expectations and emotions. And so that figure is guiding you through the story. So when you have moments, and I have these moments in all my films, where you suggest for a second that either they're not a reliable guide to these things, or that they're not as perfectly competent as you would expect, you make the audience uncomfortable, I think potentially in a productive way. But you have to be very careful with that relationship between the audience and protagonist. And it's been different on the different films I've made, because you're striving for different sympathies or different narrative effects, or you're testing that relationship between audience and protagonist in different ways. Interstellar for me is certainly, I mean, Cooper and Matthew McConaughey's interpretation of the character represents, I think, the closest relationship that I've ever tried to create between a protagonist and the audience. So he certainly isn't perfect. He certainly has a lot of things, you know, going on. But I feel that we've tried to align the audience with him emotionally more strongly, really, than any of the other protagonists I've dealt with.
I guess what I just found myself thinking about for you is about the quality of obsession that these characters tend to have. Mm. And that often robs them of what we might call emotional intelligence.
Yes. Well, I relate to that. I mean, I do a very obsessive job.
Are a lot of these guys in some ways? I mean, well, that's the obvious question.
Well, I think in a way. I mean, I think you have to be putting aspects of your own personality, whether it's your concerns or your fears or neurosis, you know, whatever that is, it has to be feeding into the protagonist of the film, or you're not putting enough of yourself in there. But, you know, I'd like to think I'm not particularly close to Bruce Wayne. I certainly don't do 1,500 push-ups a day. So Cooper is very different to me, but he is a father, and so there are emotional things that creep in there that you try and put in there. You try and make the underlying ethical dilemmas, the underlying moral quandaries, the underlying emotional stakes, you try and make those sincere and therefore personal.
Because I feel like, too, I almost find myself thinking, and I wonder if you were a fan of this film, of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. I mean, that journey that Captain Kirk has is that journey that a number of your protagonists have had, where he has to learn a lesson of self-awareness.
No, I'm a big fan of that film, actually. I hadn't thought about it in relation to this film, but it's definitely one of the science fiction movies that hangs over the movie. And I think, well, there as well are taking a very classical movie protagonist and testing them in different and unusual ways. And as I say, it sort of comes back to this relationship of the heroic figure with the audience and just trying to just pull that in a slightly different direction and then either return there or break that bond completely or whatever. And I've played around with that differently in the different films. I mean, I think The Prestige, for example, is a very, very difficult relationship between the audience and the protagonists. It's just the nature of the story. I think Interstellar is very unlike that. I think it's a very much more comfortable relationship with the protagonist.
It's a treat. We're talking about comfort and audience with Christopher Nolan, whose new film as director is Interstellar. I guess I feel like, though, for me, part of this becomes the fact that you're so accomplished in technical terms that people are looking at the films technically first. I mean, I can't think of another filmmaker who tends to sort of inspire right brain and left brain audiences in the way that you do. And that's fascinating to me.
Well, I like the geometry of films. I like the mathematical, structural thinking that can go into putting a film together. But I think films for me have always been first and foremost, you know, an aesthetic experience, a visceral experience. The reason I became a filmmaker is when I started as a child just photographing things and watching the images string together. It just makes you feel a particular way, a particular wonderment or a particular fascination. And I think over time, to me, that's grown into a concern with the emotional life of the characters, or a philosophical investigation into, you know, what makes us who we are and how we're connected, things like that. But I like balancing that with a geometrical structural conceit. I like the combination of aesthetics and science, if you like. I always admired the work of Escher. You know, there's prints, there's wonderful prints, the Penrose Steps, things like that. And, you know, they're art, they're artistic. But they're very mathematical and they're very scientific. And I think I'm very fascinated by that relationship.
There's a section in the film, I don't want to give too much away, that's very Escher-like.
Yeah, it's a sort of Escher meets Borges kind of end of the thing.
That's the emotional content audiences are looking for, yes.
Exactly. Well, with a little Steven Spielberg thrown in to bring them along. I don't know. I mean, the thing with Interstellar is I certainly, you know, wear my influences and wear my heart on my sleeve. There's no question. And I think that there are, you know, other filmmakers, writers, artists, and things that I am drawn to who do, in some way, Borges being one of them, who in some way they do embrace ideas of paradox. And I keep coming back to the word geometry. You know, it's not really science. It's sort of mathematics, but it's kind of the shape of things in a way and interesting patterns to things. But with a very human perspective to it, so that there's some either pathos or frustration or challenge emotionally, you know, to be found from those things.
But I guess, though, too, it's funny that I find myself thinking about the scale, the emotional scale of the movies. Mm. And as the stories get simpler, and they have with each film, I think, do you like the idea of taking a simple story and giving it this enormous emotional breadth and height?
I think, as I've looked back at other movies, which I do a lot, you know, I love films, I love watching films, I'm more and more drawn to the silent era.
We talked about Fritz Lang the last time you were here.
Yeah, and for this film, von Stroheim's Greed, I mean, there's something about the simplicity of the silent era. When I say simplicity, the films are incredibly complex and layered, cross-cutting, symbolic ideas going on, but there is a simplicity of sort of communication with that. And Greed is just, it's a remarkable film. And Turner did a reconstruction of it using stills and things. So much of it is lost that runs about 4 hours. And I watched that after I'd watched the shorter version. And it just gets better and better. And you just, I mean, God, I hope somebody finds it in a vault somewhere, you know, the four-hour version of it one day, because it's just incredible. But the contrast of intimacy and human concern, explained by the title and everything, you know, it really is literally about just human greed, and exploring that theme on a scale that varies from very small and intimate, you know, the parlors and, you know, rooms in San Francisco and all the rest, out to, you know, Death Valley and this extraordinary sequence at the end that I, you know, pillage from shamelessly in Interstellar.
yes, you did.
I did, but not so many people have seen it. But everyone's seen 2001. They know all the stuff I'm ripping off from 2001. Greed's a little more obscure.
But even some of the way you frame some of the, especially some of the ways you shoot McConaughey, it's like that von Stroheim thing. You were really sort of seeing the emotion in the face.
Well,
the
one
eyes.
Of the things that shooting on IMAX does is because the cameras are so big and unwieldy, and we managed to shoot, you know, well, my DP Hoyte van Hoytema did handheld shots in this. Like, he's really used it almost like a GoPro at times.
Wow.
But inherently, the size of the medium, the noise of the camera, just the largeness of it, the grandeur of this device on set, it naturally pushes you, I think, towards a more classical construction of the shots, the tableau shots, and even the editing rhythms. It just sort of reminds you of the aspiration of the film every time you look at this camera on set.
It even reminds you of the old days when they had to be silent because the cameras are so noisy they couldn't record anything on the set anyway.
Exactly. I mean, luckily in Interstellar, we've got people wearing helmets. So we could actually record pretty intimate scenes and the microphones inside the helmets. So you could actually get the live sound. So we really pushed the situations in which we use these cameras very, very far. And I think we shot all kinds of different scenes. So it's all possible. But you never quite forget the sort of weightiness, really, of the medium you're using. And I think it does take you back a little bit to the silent era. It does kind of make you think a little bit more in these sort of big image sort of ways, which seems right for the subject matter.
But it's funny you're talking about Greed. I was just thinking about what Greed is really finally about, too, is this thing we've been talking about since the beginning, which is that operatic sense of yearning. Mm. And that thing, those things are, well, perpetually.
Yeah.
Out of
it's
your grasp.
Taking the smallest, most intimate emotion or yearning of a character, and then playing it out on a colossal scale for the rest of the world to sort of experience. And that, to me, is what movies can do that nothing else can do.
Every last question I want to ask you before you go, just had Quentin Tarantino on a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about film, and I don't know how much proof there is, sort of anecdotal proof, but my feeling has always been that the flicker of the projector does something to the brain chemistry that's entirely different than seeing a digital image projected.
I think that's entirely possible. There are a lot of different anomalies to film. and film projection in particular, because film acquisition, you know, you make the case for and based on quality of color reproduction, resolution, all these things. Film projection, which has, you know, largely gone away, and we've made a big deal about the film prints that we're putting out there because we really want people to try and see it in that way. It's a harder thing to get a handle on. I think a lot of it is the flicker. There's a particular quality to the light, you know, passing through the celluloid. It has a slightly different look and a slightly different feel, even in the way colors are represented in skies and things like that.
And blacks.
And the blacks very much. And the different film formats different as well, where they've got, you know, we've got 70mm prints out there, 35mm prints and all the rest. And people will sort of argue the toss, is it better, is it worse? You know, it definitely has a feeling and a quality, a particular quality of magic that I very much appreciate and really enjoy. And so my hope is that we can, you know, carve out a niche for it amongst the, you know, the more practical, you know, digital projection that goes on, and it's mostly Interstellar's going out on digital prints, and I'm very happy with the way those are looking. But it would be nice to carve out the little space for film, because I do think it has something to it that it's a little bit difficult to quantify. I mean, it's one of the themes of the film. There are these things, you can take science just so far, and then there are things that you have to trust that you feel. And a lot of what I do as a filmmaker is this weird balance between science and technology and analytical thinking. And then what do you feel? What feels right?
Do you show projected films to your kids? I'm just wondering if you can see a difference with them in the way that they take them in.
I do when I can, but I mostly show them Blu-rays projected. And I have a very good digital projector that shows Blu-rays. And the quality of that as a home format is extraordinary. But wherever possible, I try and take them to a real movie theater and show them real film print. I show them the right stuff, you know, because it was an excuse. You know, I needed to see it for research because I want to see how they did all those great things they did. But we screen film prints of classic films that we're interested in before every film, and always on print. We would never, you know, do it any other way. And they are vastly different experiences. Films that you think you know, whether it's like, I remember screening The Shining or Barry Lyndon, I mean, Kubrick's work. I'd watch it on TV, you know, I'd watch it on home video, and it was a completely different experience looking at a film print. A lot of those films are like that. And the right stuff, certainly on film, I mean, it's just extraordinary.
As a film, too, there are a lot of practical effects rather than...
A lot of practical effects. That was really why we were looking at it, because I was trying to convince everybody to go with no green screens, to try and make cockpits for the actors that they could sit in that were like simulators rather than sets. And when you look back at the right stuff, I mean, there are optical effects in there, but there's a lot of practical stuff that was done with front projection, rear projection, reflections, you know, the helmets and these things, and extraordinary effects and miniature effects. And so we did look at it and sort of go, okay, if they could do that in 1983 with all the resources we have now, particularly with digital projection on set, you know, the keystone corrections you can do, the versatility of where you can put the projectors and all this sort of stuff, we should be able to take it to the next level, and that's what we really try to do.
Well, at time, just let you know, as long as I have a show here, you have a place here.
Thank you, Albert.
My pleasure. My guest is Christopher Nolan, whose new film is director is Interstellar. The show is recorded at NPR West by Leo DeLacula. It's mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm going to go see a silent film. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's a treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.